nightmare.
Hello and welcome to Cinema Subculture, the podcast where we discuss everything strange, obscure and downright messed up in the world of movies. My name's Gary.
And I'm Simon.
So what are we discussing on this episode?
This episode we're going to be looking at Dario Argento's Suspiria, released in 1977.
Will we do a plot rundown?
Yeah.
Okay, so Susie Banyan is an American ballet student travelling to Germany to study at an exclusive dance academy. But after one of the students and her friend are murdered, Susie discovers that the academy has a bizarre history, and as the body count rises, gets involved in a hideous labyrinth of murder, black magic and madness.
That's quite a concise synopsis. Where did you find that?
Amazon.
Right. No, because look, from the film doesn't even give you that much.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, doesn't take you by the hand necessarily. So, this wasn't the first time you'd seen the film?
It wasn't, no.
No, no. So, a couple years ago?
But it was time for a reappraisal.
Yeah, I mean, I'd heard of this film along with Tenebrae and things like that maybe about 8 years ago. Like, I remember specifically I was on holiday and I met this guy and he was really into his kind of horror films. And I mean, that's kind of what I like as well. So, but he was going, you know, talking about all these things. That was the first time I'd heard about the guinea pig movies and he brought up like Tenebrae and Suspiria and things like that, and he recommended I watch them. But I never ever did anything about it, like, other than probably American DVD releases,
right?
They weren't probably that available. So it's taken me really to now to see this film specifically. And I'm kind of glad that I've waited, because I don't know how I would have watched it had I not seen some of his other films.
Sure,
you know, and maybe like seen like Deep Red and things like that in the lead up to. You know, how he got to this film. So I'm kind of glad that, as I say, I waited to this point to see it. I thought it was just like, having only seen his like kind of his yellow films, I thought it was just completely different for him. You know, it was kind of obviously hinted there in Deep Red. There was, as I say, there was kind of elements of hinting at like supernatural goings on that never really paid off.
Yeah, this was like his first film that was kind of pure supernatural horror. He'd mainly just done giallos to this point.
Yeah, like, he'd done like a kind of he did the 5 days, I think it was called.
Right.
It was more of a kind of historical thing.
Right, he made one comedy as well, I think.
Maybe that was that. I thought it was more of a kind of...
I don't know if that's considered canon.
Right,
in his filmography, I'm not
sure. But certainly, I mean, a large departure from the kind of genre that he'd become famous for.
Yeah, yeah. So the first time I saw it was a couple of years ago, and I'd went into it reading, I think it was a total film review, giving it 5 stars.
Right.
So I went into it thinking, okay, classic horror. But I didn't really get it. I thought it had some quite spectacular set pieces, but... I don't know, I think Argento is a bit of an acquired taste. He has a definite style, which doesn't really necessarily fit in sort of classic filmmaking. But on rewatching it, I thought it was extremely good. I have been kind of critical of Argento's style in the past, particularly see the Tenebrae episode.
Yeah.
But I think this one, and I've recently watched Deep Red. I think in those films, why they're successful is his style. He keeps everything quite disciplined. Whereas I think you need that with his style, which is extremely superficial, but I don't necessarily mean that to be pejorative.
Sure.
It's all about just putting the image on screen and creating a kind of surreal atmosphere. I think in these later works, because you don't have a strong narrative, if he gets to sometimes maybe with Tenebrae tries to just kind of throw too much in there in terms of all the different shots, and sometimes it's like it seems he's lacking discipline and he just kind of pared it down. It's like, right, let's try this, all these crazy shots and different like angles and too many things going on.
Sure.
So I think the discipline of maybe Deep Red in this kind of keep a handle on the superficiality of the narrative. in a way.
Yeah.
I think maybe with Tenebrae, like later on, it's just his kind of a dictatorial ego kind of out of control. So if it's not working technically and it's not really a narrative there to balance that, then maybe that's why.
Maybe, yeah.
Tenebrae or something like, I think Opera is a terrible film.
Right, okay.
I mean, saying this, I'm not that familiar with, I've not seen everything, so, but take this with a pinch of salt. But, this film in particular, it is, I would say it's a mark of his style. It's like highly theatrical and very expressionist. Both in sort of rejection of kind of naturalistic acting and also his mise-en-scene. Especially with use of lighting and colour in the film. It's very striking. Yeah. This obviously suggests the kind of psychological states of the characters. It's also kind of, it's notable for his rejection of kind of causal logic and rationality, and kind of just plots are crazy, don't really make sense. It's a successful film. Maybe one is a signature film.
Well, I mean, it definitely seems to be that. I mean, that's the one that kind of everyone kind of talks about. I mean, you hear Tenebrae and you hear like Deep Red, definitely. But Suspiria seems to stand out in people's memories. I think a lot of that, I think, is the opening 20 minutes. I mean, really, like, I mean, right from the shot in the airport, where like it's almost as if the sound, certain sounds are being isolated.
Aye.
You know, and you hear nothing except for like at one point the door, the mechanism of the door, and it's just really unsettling, and you don't really know what's happening and or why he's doing it.
Yeah.
And it's like there's nothing scary at the airport. Yeah. Nothing happens. But it's just so unsettling because you're not used to it. And then the score from Goblin just comes in out of nowhere, and nothing's even happened yet, and you just are like, why are we meant to, you know, because music's usually so leading, and especially in horror films, and you're like, why are we meant to be scared at this point? Like, right. I don't understand. And it kind of puts you so on edge, right up into that kind of climactic scene of the woman coming through the glass roof.
Yeah.
Which is just like, the way it's even just cut together is really quite striking, I think.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Really strong. I mean, I noticed you were watching, there's stuff in there now that's very commonplace in horror films now, but I don't know if they were so much then, because, I mean, that was 1977 before even Halloween, so there's stuff in there that was probably amongst the first, especially the first that became mainstream. I mean, this film hit pretty big and was quite big in Latin America and things as well, so I think, it was quite early on, so it may have been the first time we were seeing a lot of the kind of traditional, like the bit where she's at the window at the beginning, you know, and the music's there, and
right.
You know, it seemed very, like, to me, it just seemed like it could have been out of any horror film.
Sure, like when the hand comes in.
Yes,
grabs
yeah.
Right.
But I'm not saying it's the first use, obviously, but like it's very early on, you know, and the kind of, if you're going to show the parallels of his, like, the Gigli crossing over into like American 80s slasher, as it did,
sure.
There's definitely elements there that would be absorbed into the kind of mainstream horror film. Mm. So I think that opening 20 minutes, I don't think it's topped in the rest of the film. There are definitely crescendos of like tension and anxiety and. Just, I mean, it's weird. Like, there's colour. I mean, you know, the story is very. It's just there and no more. You get the basics. The basic story is the American girl goes to a foreign school for dancing and there's witchcraft.
Yeah,
that's it. You know what I mean? There are witches. So,
He sets himself a high watermark there. Mm-hmm. Difficult to top that. But I think that first.
I think that's what he was going for, though. I think his whole thing was like. If people see this, it's almost like this is like a climax to a film. This is like a climax in other films. Mm. So like, I think he was going for, like, if people see this first 20 minutes, they won't know what to expect for the rest of the film. Because like, you've kind of like slapped your cards on the table. I was going to go dirty there. and, you know, where do you go from there?
Definitely. That first set piece is pretty majestic. It's maybe one of the best things he's ever done, best sections of any
just of his builds movies. And builds, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Yeah, he does quite a good job of holding kind of long takes to building up the tension. Then it kind of bursts into these dynamic editing shifts, particularly in terms of like shifts in dynamic composition, and also like shifting between extreme high and low angles. And also, there seems to be like shifts which aren't completely diegetic in terms of locations. It seems to be like what it'll cut, and then like the actress will be outside, and it's like, is it kind of just outside the window? It's not really clear. Plus, like shifting color tone and stuff like that, it makes it kind of just kind of really surreal, which really works. So
I really like, I mean, obviously, the lighting and stuff. I mean, there's been so much said in this film, you know, about this film specifically. I mean, that's the first thing you hear from people when they tell you about Suspiria, the color, and you know. But I, like, personally, I just thought that the way what I didn't necessarily expect was the way that he used color to represent like unseen characters almost.
Okay, yeah.
You know what I mean? There's a couple of the key points in the film where it's almost that we're with it's depicted. I mean, there's a specific bit when they're having the sleepover and everything's red and the big white sheet are put up around where they're sleeping, and everything's in red when they're going to go to sleep, and we kind of see a silhouette behind it moving, right? So that's obviously a direct character. You can see that's a character. There's another part where they're in like one of the bedrooms, and the light kind of, it's as if someone's walking along the corridor, and then the light kind of moves, and then it, as if there's someone in the next room,
okay,
across the wall. It's almost that we're having like a kind of X-ray, view of this wall. And then later on, there's a part that moves right up to the window. A clear glass window above a door, and I didn't really expect that. I mean, you know, you see it in the first bit, and obviously it's very striking, the colours he's using. There's a lot of kind of like just very unnatural colours, I guess, leading to, you know, kind of the supernatural elements that are in the film. But I thought that was quite ingenious and very much like, again, unsettling, because you're like, what is that? A visual representation that we are seeing only? Is it something the characters are seeing, or is it just, you know what I mean? You just, it's really weird. It's not something that I had really seen before. I mean, I think like things like, I think they did it in like some black and white movies and some silent movies. I think I remember seeing like light, just like plain white light kind of moving. Okay. Obviously, you know, I think they did that a lot more then, or like in Dracula when they've just got the light on his eyes and things like that. Obviously, kind of signaling supernatural or focus things. This was very clear and kind of almost, as I say, you're not sure whether it's something that's only in tone, or if it's something the characters can kind of see, or you know, because the light. So again, that's something that, even though I knew about the going in with the drastic light set up and the different colours and things, that wasn't something I was expecting. So that was quite clever and really off-putting, unsettling. Sorry, you know.
Yeah, definitely. I think that was a kind of idea going into the film, because they chose to. It was one of the last films shot on Technicolor process, to really get those kind of really vibrant colours, which aren't especially realistic, but it creates a kind of really intense intense colour effects.
I mean, going like into like the writing of this film, Dario Dario Argento and Daria Nicolodi, I don't think they were ever married, but they were together. It's Asia Argento's mum. They are credited as writing the film, but I think there's a bit of dispute because they like parted ways eventually, but of who like kind of came up with the story and things like that. There's a bit, I think, I think they're in better terms now, like the two of them, but I think for a while, I think Asia Argento tells stories of them having arguments about who like started the film and things like that. Cause, but I think Argento's a bit notorious for like stealing credit. I think there's something in one of his other films, and it's like written and directed by Dario Argento, and later on it's like, oh yeah, also written by you know. But
yeah, that documentary I watched, Dari was claiming she wrote it, and saying she was kind of gracious, saying Dario kind of wrote the film visually. But she was saying it was based on a story of our grandmother. So she was claiming, taking the credit there.
It's pretty funny, I mean, but like, So it kind of makes you wonder like where the look and feel of the film came. I mean, the cinematographer was Luciano Tavoli. Mm. That he also shot Inferno, I believe, as well.
Okay.
I think, and he shot Tenebrae.
Mm.
So, I mean, I've not seen Inferno, but like Suspiria and Tenebrae are very different looking films. So it kind of makes you wonder where the idea for the colour setup originated, you know, forgetting who wrote the story or...
Yeah.
I mean, again, this could have been quite a simple...
Mm.
Like a fairly boring, you know what I mean? Like, kind of, by the cards, like, which story?
Okay.
By today's standards. But even now, today, with that colour design and the way it's put together and just some of the surreal set pieces, it still, you know, it still triggers interest now, you know? Mm-hmm. So... don't know what I'm trying to say really there. I guess the music by Goblin as well. I mean, that's something that makes it stand out now as well.
Definitely elevates it.
I've got to admit, I really like Tenebrae. I do. And I saw Deep Red after that, and I think that's probably a stronger film, definitely. But something about when he's got Goblin for his music, there's something definitely, you know, because I mean, the music for this, although in Tenebrae it's really rhythmic and catchy, right? And this it's totally almost industrial.
Okay.
Yeah, and just like kind of, it's more like a score in this rather than like a tune,
right? Okay.
Like in Tenebrae and even Phenomena, I think, as well.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if it'd work as well without that music, because you may sort of criticize them for over reliance on music. Particularly at the end, where it just seems to be like turn it up a bit more, just get more intensity. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it works. It's pretty much a perfect kind of match.
I mean, I think this film, because of the subject matter, I think this does let him just loose on it. He doesn't really have to worry about, because logic doesn't really need to work in this film. You know, you could criticize He's more kind of like some, you know, kind of they talk about him being the Italian Hitchcock, right? So some of his more kind of Hitchcockian like set pieces, and you could criticize them for their logic,
right?
Right? I mean, you could, like, because some of them just don't make sense. But with this, it doesn't need to make sense, and maybe that's because there's no like direct correlation between the Hitchcock thing you're making in your head.
Right.
You know, you're getting with it, those other films expecting like this kind of, same as you were with this, like, you know, expecting like a 5-star film or something of the caliber of like a Hitchcock film.
Right.
Whereas with this, it's kind of like, as soon as you kind of, well, again, get in knowing that it's more of a supernatural thing rather than his previous films, you kind of don't even, like, you're not trying to make any comparisons to like that, you know?
Sure.
And any logic that goes, I mean, the part where the girl falls into the cave, well, I think it's supposed to be razor wire.
All right.
I think I heard is it Alan Jones and Kim Newman talking about that?
Right, okay.
That apparently it's meant to be razor wire, right. But you can clearly see that it's not. And she gets tangled up. I mean, that kind of, why is that even there?
Yeah.
Right, so it's not logical at all. I mean, and had it been in one of his other films, you could argue, like, wait a minute, this is the real world. What's... Okay. This doesn't make any sense. That's there for a set piece, which it is.
Mm.
But in this, because of the elements that are there, it doesn't even matter, you know? It's like,
yeah,
you just kind of give him a pass because of the type of film it is.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of why he maybe shines more in this than, you know, and again, in Deep Red, like, has the kind of hints of the supernatural, so you kind of, you don't know where that's going, so you kind of allow any leaps in logic that you have in that film. Although I think that film stands pretty strong, Deep Red.
Yeah.
But I think this kind of was his playground. He just kind of could do anything he wanted, really.
Yeah.
Story-wise.
Yeah, yeah.
And to service his style.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, possibly. You sometimes feel like he's just kind of waiting to get to the next set piece.
Mm-hmm.
You could maybe criticise him for, like, using them too much and them being a wee bit contrived, just because you got the kind of the plot there to justify it. I mean, there's even that one where you have, like, well, there's the scene where the maggots start coming through the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
which is a set piece in itself.
Sure.
Which then goes on to justify another set piece.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where they're all sleeping in the big,
I mean,
hall.
That logic in the end of the films, you'd be like, wait a minute, this is... But in this, Like, as soon as you see, because like, you can explain anything away with those witches there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, so instantly, as soon as you say that, and someone says, oh, but it's magic.
Mm.
You know, yeah. You can kind of explain anything away, and I think that gives them the freedom to do those.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, some of those, like, the maggot set piece is kind of weird, and you don't know where it's going, and it's kind of cool, but the scene in the makeshift dormitory is you know, they set up all the beds.
Yeah.
It's pretty strong, like visually and kind of, like, sound design, yeah, yeah. You know? So I think to get there, it does kind of... That's literally, you're right, that's literally why he's trying to get to explain that.
Yeah, it's very foolish to just to criticise him for that, because that's what he does. Mm. But
and as I say, I feel he does that in all his films, but in this film, you can explain it away, because it doesn't have to be logical.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I mean, the magazine, why have they got meat stored in the loft? It's like, what's that about?
Yeah.
Not put it in the freezer. Oh, but it's room in the loft. Stick
oh,
it up
no,
there.
But what did you put it in the loft? Did they? You can that?
No, but there's a number of pretty stunning set pieces. The blind pianist getting murdered in the square.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
pretty
that
stunning.
Was, uh-huh.
Just really extreme, like, long shots of him just isolated in this massive square. Yeah, another good one is Susie. She gets kind of stuck in the hall. She gets kind of blinded by a light.
Oh yeah,
off a knife
yeah. That
or
was that really. When I was watching that really kind of messed me up a wee bit, because I was like, what's happening? I wasn't quite there for the whole, like, this isn't going to necessarily make sense yet. but really visually, like, in kind of, like, again, sound design just comes thumping in, like, literally thumping in, you know, and we see the character visually get, like, a headache and be kind of weakened. And you kind of almost get that, like, from the visual and the sound design. It's literally, like, I mean, I said to you at the time we're watching it, it's like, he manages to do stuff with light, and literally in that case, it's like a light reflected off a mirror or a prism that you now would, people would probably use, like, special effects for now, right?
Yeah.
You know, and so he's getting, like, these kind of free special effects that work and get across what they're doing, you know, like, and that bit with the reflection light, you actually see a bar of light coming across the screen to the character.
Yeah.
Right, and I mean, now it just looks like a lens flare, that's fine, but it works also, like, in that, like, this kind of, like, really lo-fi special effect, you know? And again, with the light moving in the walls and stuff, that stuff that people would probably be lazying it with now and just do, like, in CG.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite striking when you see that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we see that the creepy women, like, they're the cooks or something, like, you see them later on, and they're having their laugh in the kitchen. They're actually, like, you see they're kind of normal people.
Yeah, right. it's
kind of, that makes it even worse, I think. but yeah.
What do you think of the cinematography in the film, and more in terms of camera movement and things like that?
Knowing that it's the same person that shot Tenebrae, which I feel, like, again, it is a very distinctive look. I feel this film's a much more competent and tighter film.
Right, yeah.
Maybe, again, what you're saying about, like, you know, him being stricter with his ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we commented in the Tenebrae episode about the tracking shot up from one side of the house.
Yeah.
And, whereas with this, if the guy's responsible for the lighting and stuff like that, which I presume he probably was, I think the look of it is brilliant. I think it just is. I mean, the shot of the swimming pool with the two of them in it, and the pool's blue, but they're lit up in red, and you know, it's just it's really striking. And I wouldn't have said before knowing that the same guy had shot the two films, like Tenebrae and Suspiria.
Okay. But it's a lot of beautiful moves and all that sort of crane moves, I think.
Yeah, definitely. That the scene at the beginning we're talking about there, the amount of shots there is, that you wouldn't think there'd be so many nicely composed shots.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's there's so many, like, different cuts in that scene.
Right.
And they all look beautiful, you know.
Mm-hmm. It does do some interesting things with sort of reversing traditional editing techniques, where instead of, like, wide shot cut or move in.
Mm-hmm.
He'll, like, move in. He'll, like, start from, like, a close up and then pull out.
Yeah.
Which is quite cool. Particularly one is the Olga character painting her nails, I think.
Yes. Uh-huh.
It's like the red and then he comes out and you see the...
That's right.
It's quite cool.
Also, the scene with... what's his name? Udo Kier?
Yeah.
In the like kind of plaza, wherever they are. There's no two shots the same almost there.
Yeah.
Like, even to the point where some of the shots are like over-shoulder shots cutting off half of the other character's face.
Right.
And stuff like that, which seem a little ridiculous at the time, but the extreme, like, high...
Yeah.
Like shots and you know, and then like the lows again, like you're saying, and then that one that kind of zooms in between them when the other guy comes.
That is a cool shot.
Yeah, and it goes into the reflection. Yeah,
I was going to say though that those scenes are maybe the kind of few instances in the film where it does throw too much up there.
That's but because it seems such like a. It's the film would have worked without that scene in it.
Right, okay.
It doesn't need that. It's like an exposition scene for something we can already get.
Right. You know, but, yeah.
I mean, it gives you the detail
right.
about who the witch is and... Right, but you kind of know... You don't necessarily need it so much.
Right.
You know what I think? Like, it seems a bit like...
I don't
apparently
know.
There was a thing, like... Because there was some German money... Obviously, it's set in Germany, I think. Yeah. That was behind the financing of this, and I think there was a like because Udo Kier was like the biggest like star
right,
at that
yeah.
point in Germany or whatever. So like they were saying like I think Kim Newman and Alan Jones were saying that that was the only reason for that scene was to get like, Udo Kier in
okay,
it,
right.
you know, and have him come in for this right. like 2 days to do this kind of exposition scene.
Right.
But
I mean, I didn't have problems with it in terms of content. I just thought that did he not say somewhere that he had the idea of not having two identical shots.
Yeah.
Which is a...
I like the idea. It's nice.
Right.
It's an interesting idea in paper. There's a... Rob Zombie had a similar thing when he was talking about shooting Devil's Rejects because
right.
he wanted it to feel more like... Look, you know, not... Feel more like a documentary type style thing rather than... He felt like if you went back... If you shoot wide... A shot, right, and then cut to close up, then back to the exact same wide shot.
Yeah,
it feels very much like a movie.
Okay,
which is fine, but he was going for like a more kind of guerrilla shot,
right?
Like thing, you know, like he had a lot of cameras inside this. There was this one scene anyway, it was a shootout at a house, and he had a lot of different cameramen in the house, shooting at the same time as everything was going on. So he didn't cut to the same shot or this like a wide sub, you know, shot twice. And I mean, in that it works for me. Like I never noticed it really until he pointed it out,
right.
which is the way it should be, you know.
Yeah.
But he never cuts back to like the same shot twice.
Okay.
Whereas in this, that he's doing the same thing, but the problem here is that the scene there's not much going on in the scene.
Yeah.
So it's two people sitting. So if it was like the shot at the beginning, the 20-minute sequence, right, or even just when she gets to her back to her house and she's been terrorized, that's fine there because there's lots happening.
Okay, yeah.
Whereas with this, it's a scene that I'm not saying that okay, maybe it does need to be in the film, but he's trying to make it more interesting than it is visually.
Yeah, it does seem a kind of in that instance, it's a kind of shallow exercise in form. It's really unnecessary. It's a conversation. You can just shoot it traditionally. Whereas the fact that you're going over the shoulder, but then you're moving the angle, so it's like you're just seeing the back of a guy's head.
That seems like it's
kind of...
Whereas, I mean, you could have shot that and like still never cut to the same shot twice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you could have still used his ridiculously high shot, because that works okay.
Mm.
You know, a two shot of the two of them, that's fine.
Mm.
Close up in each.
Right.
But you don't have to keep cutting.
Mm.
You know, that's the thing. His problem is he's cutting too often almost, and he can still even done the shot into the reflection.
Right.
You know, but it's when you say when it becomes that. That's what I'm saying. That glaringly felt to us like what's he doing there?
Yeah.
But then he spoke about that, and there was a documentary in the Blu-ray that he was talking about. I think it was that one anyway. He was talking about his style. He was talking to one of his kind of was it. Who was it he was talking about? I can't remember. But he was talking about like whether two different types of filmmaking.
Oh, that thing Pasolini said about cinema of poetry or cinema of prose, was it?
Yeah. And like, whereas Pasolini said like you're not necessarily aware of the camera.
Right. Mm.
Whereas Argento openly admits that it's the opposite for him. You're distinctively aware of the camera
and
what he's doing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is his style. But I think for that scene, it becomes...
Yeah,
detrimental to the the it takes you out of the story a wee bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But for a simple scene, it didn't really need to be as dynamic as he was trying to make it, I don't think, based on what I'm saying.
In terms of the plotting, which there's not much to say about, but it does use one traditional Argento thing where you have a protagonist and they see something, but they don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. They know they've seen it, but they kinda, it's a secret, and then they spend the rest of the film trying to figure it out, which I think in the films I've seen, it's Bird with Crystal Plumage, it does that, Deep Red does that.
Tenebrae less, so I don't think really, because, well, spoilers, but the main protagonist is the main antagonist really in that film.
Right, aye.
You know, there's not anything.
Yeah.
I guess you could argue that reading his book like, is something that's but Deep Red, I mean, I think it works slightly better in Deep Red, but it's more, even more prominent because it gives everything away before.
Mm.
Like, in the days when I can pause my Blu-ray when I'm watching it and see what the fuck was that in that mirror, which I did.
Like, then you're right, because, okay.
You know, you're instantly right, well, I know what's going on.
Right.
But, like, watching that at the cinema, it's that and gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, cinematically, it's well-constructed, that film.
Okay.
Because it was made before the days of home video where you could pause.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And rewind.
Aye.
So, but yeah, no, this one's a wee bit... It works really well until you know what she said. Because it doesn't really help you out in it, you know what I mean? Once you're in that room and you see the blue flower,
aye,
okay, you get it, but like, you know, she has to get to that room first.
Yeah.
Before she can make a sense of what she's actually said.
Sure. And it's a wee bit pointless. Like, who's that character telling that to?
That's it.
Because she doesn't know what's going on.
No,
she's
that's
in a frenzy. But it drives the plot. Mm-hmm. She's figuring it.
Yeah,
something about a flower to figure out.
It's almost like it's just weird and like illogical enough for you to let it go. You know what I mean? It's kind of because you kind of like, who is she talking to? But then, by the time you've thought of that, you're thinking, but what's she saying? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It kind of takes you in, and then even when she's trying to remember it, you don't even like. I didn't like. Naturally think, well, who is she actually talking to? Because it's just weird enough to like keep you going, you know. So have you ever seen Inferno?
I haven't, no.
No. This one I wasn't necessarily, I'd heard that, well, I think it was lower budget and lower key than this when it was out and things. But I think, I mean, it's, as far as I'm led to believe, it's still pretty strong.
Right. I was rereading the chapter on Argento in Kim Newman's book there.
Sure.
He calls that his masterpiece.
Right, yeah. Right. So definitely worth a watch. And I think I was listening to the commentary on the Blu-ray for Suspiria, and they were, I think that Kim Newman and Alan Jones were both pretty disappointed with Mother of Tears. I think there's a couple of scenes when they were watching back Suspiria this time that they like they could see where the scenes in Mother of Tears had come from.
All right.
As in, like, there was direct parallels from what was happening. You know, callbacks almost, you know. I think what they mostly disappointed with was the look of it. There was none of the kind of striking, the zit colour design and things like that.
Mm.
And I think they said that literally, and it's such a shame because now he could have done it with, if he'd wanted to, like, CG.
Yeah, yeah.
As in, like, he didn't have to do it practically. It wouldn't have taken him that long to, you know, do it in post, which, I mean, I don't know. I'd heard about that before it came out. Not really, only knowing, like, kind of, probably not even having actually seen any Argento films, but just knowing the kind of story around Suspiria and Inferno and the supposed third film. So I can remember before it came out, and then I remember the disappointment of it when it kind of hit and stuff, but I think it'd be worth...
Is that quite recently?
In the last 5-10 years, it's been out. Maybe like 2005 or something like that. I could probably tell you. I can tell you. What I'm talking about, I can tell you. I have the power of the internet, you see. Mother of Tears was released in 2007. So, I think that went through a lot of... I mean, there's like literally in the wiki page, there's like the Nicolodi script was written in the 80s. She wrote a draft. Argento script he wrote in 2003 or 4, and then there was two other writers brought in 2005 and 2006. I think that might be the problem.
Right.
But even so, I mean, like, in none of Argento's films, and especially not this one, is the story or the script that important. You know what I mean? There's no real clangers in this film that take you out, you know, dodgy dialogue. I mean, yeah. the names that begin with S being right. people that are snakes, maybe, but that's kind of funny. That's okay.
Right.
So really, it seems like the look that's let down Mother of Tears more than anything else. Which is a shame because I think it was like awaited for so long by like Argento's fans of specifically Suspiria and Inferno. But no, I'm definitely going to check out Inferno.
Yeah.
I think that'll be...
Do you own that?
No, I don't own that, no. Because the Arrow one's apparently kind of gashed the...
Is it?
The transfer on it, so I might wait or see what the Blue Underground one's like. Incidentally, if anyone's interested, I think the UK Blu-ray, which is what we watched, the colours and the contrast and that are quite a bit off, apparently, on it. I'm actually tuning the colours my TV a wee bit better and get them looking more like what they should. But I think there's some clear bits in it where the contrast totally blows out. Some of the, because the wallpaper, like this in the school, and the look of the school is like really, really interesting. And there's bits where it just seems to be blown out in contrast. So I think actually that doc, that article you posted on Facebook about from the guy that did the restorations for Arrow, had mentioned Suspiria specifically. Okay. It could do with a new restoration.
Right, yeah.
So I'd definitely agree with that. But, I mean, saying that, the Blu-ray looked pretty good. I mean, clarity and things like that looked good. It was just sometimes the contrast was pumped far too high.
Yeah, yeah.
And the colours natively on my TV looked a wee bit too pinkish rather than red. But, hey-ho, just out of interest.
Aye.
So what films of Argento that you've seen now then?
Okay, Bird with a Crystal Plumage.
Deep Red.
Suspiria, Tenebrae, Opera. I haven't seen Cat and Nine Tails, Four Flies and Grey Velvet. Inferno.
I've seen Bird of the Crystal Plumage, Cat and Nine Tails, Deep Red, Suspiria, Tenebrae. I think that's it. I own Four Flies and Phenomena, but I haven't watched them yet.
Right. Yeah, maybe once you get to Tenebrae, is that maybe that's essential.
They say that Phenomena was his last good one.
Right. Was it after?
Yeah.
Okay.
That was, I think it was Suspiria then.
All right.
Tenebrae then Phenomena, maybe? No.
1985.
Tenebrae then Phenomena, and then after that was Opera.
Mm.
Although I've heard that Two Evil Eyes ain't bad. That's only there with George Romero.
Okay.
As I say, I've got Four Flies and Phenomena. So that and Inferno will kind of complete the early to like mid Argento. I was quite interested in the film Giallo when it first came out.
Why?
Because it's Adrian Brody in it, and it's, you know, it's like him kind of properly, well, like returning in the modern day to that genre.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's really bad. Like, I think it really slated. I think like Kim Newman and Alan Jones were speaking, saying that they reckoned it was like because it was his kind of first like foray into working with like an American studio proper. It didn't really go well.
Okay.
But which kind of sucks. And I think Dracula 3D is meant to be a kind of the Room of Argento films, if you get me. I would actually if it was to were to come to like, the GFT in 3D, I would go.
Right. Okay.
I would go. Apparently it is kind of that, not necessarily so bad. It's good, but like, it'll keep you talking afterwards. Right, okay. You know, there's some schlocky kind of 3D stuff. And I would quite like to see it just to see what all the fuss is about or not about, whatever. But yeah, I'd definitely say it'd be between this and Deep Red for the best that I've seen.
Right, yeah.
From Argento. Although, bird and the bird of crystal plumage and Tenebrae are just on the outside of that for me.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I think Tenebrae's his most fun film I've watched.
Yeah, could be.
Kind of, it's very, as I say, I've said, it's kind of a cross between the kind of, like, Murder, She Wrote, or Dick Van Dyke, you know, from Diagnosis Murder.
Yeah.
And, like, a kind of Argento film. So, but yeah. What about yourself? How would you, like, estimate it in the ones you've seen? Like, you know, Suspiria, where would you hold it?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely up there. That and Deep Red, I think. Mm. In terms of just technical quality and technical discipline, I think seem to be the things that work for me in these two, more than the rest.
You were saying when we were watching this about the... Because obviously you'd mentioned about his misogyny in the past.
Mm.
I know you said it to me already, but like, you can explain it to him again what you're saying about the whole, what was that, the test?
Oh, the Bechdel test.
Yes, so.
If anyone's not familiar, sure. This is a test that Alison Bechdel that came up with the idea for this test, which is to discover the feminist merits of any work of fiction. So it's basically three questions you ask, which is there two female characters? It's sometimes refined to say, is there two named female characters?
Okay.
Secondly, do they have a conversation? And thirdly, do they talk about something other than men? And there's a very few films, supposedly, that actually pass the test. But this one does. I don't know. It's interesting to think about it as a feminist work, because I'm not sure it's interesting. There's hardly any male characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
But it does maybe... The female characters are still in the horror vein of kind of objectified victims,
mm-hmm.
Even though they are victims of other women. Mm-hmm. Way. But
although I mean, the character of Susie, yeah, she really in the film feels like a victim. Mm. You know, she doesn't really. I don't know. There's no, like she's quite headstrong.
Yeah.
And she doesn't really run from the danger. Once she's into the room with the kind of witch, she's right in there. She's going. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So it's kind of like she kind of. I mean, I think she kind of crosses over in certain elements to like a kind of a traditional male hero role that you would see. You know. Mm. So I think it kind of. I don't think she's definitely an amalgamation of your last girl kind of idea, right? But like she's stronger than even like, well, she's definitely stronger than like your Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, but it's maybe like a kind of a Nancy from Nightmare, you know, like where she's kind of taking it into her own hands and kind of going after the big bad, as it were.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, it's weird that because like really there is no point. There's a slight hint of that guy, but we reckon that he might be homosexual. But the kind of other guy that kind of waves at her.
Yeah, that's interesting. Most of the male characters are either kind of portrayed as homosexual or like
blind or homosexual. Yeah.
And he does go for a kind of progressive. Maybe there's a sort of undertones of lesbianism, but not in
that,
a kind of.
He said he was kind of like he didn't feel like he pushed it as far as he wanted to.
Right. Yeah, but it's not a lesbian relationship that's exploitative.
I mean, he'd mentioned originally. I think he'd originally wanted to cast like 13 and 14-year-olds as the girls.
Mm.
But I think they felt like at that point with that age of person in like a horror film, it might, you know, like being so explicit with the violence, maybe that they wouldn't have been able to make it or whatever.
Mm.
So I think those things like production design, they made like the doors higher and things like that to make them seem younger and
right.
So I mean, even if the implied lesbian undertones, I think that it would have probably been pretty innocent anyway.
Mm.
You know.
Mm.
But hey ho.
Right, so we'll run down some of the cut history of the film.
Yeah.
Originally, in 1977, it was passed the cinema release with an exit certificate with 1 minute 13 seconds of cuts.
That in the UK, yeah. Yeah, that's all the UK.
Then it was released uncut on VHS by Thorn EMI, who then later replaced that with a cut version. Just in the Video Nasty era, although it was never an official targeted film, but I think it came into the Section 3 list. Okay. Getting more up to date. It was passed uncut in 2007.
Sure.
In the UK. And it's been essentially uncut since, but this is quite interesting that I didn't know.
Uh-huh.
It's saying that the recent Blu-ray and DVD are uncut, although missing a few shots.
Right.
It says past 18 without BBFC cuts, albeit missing a few shots from the opening murder, but this is generally accepted as an uncut version.
I didn't know that.
It says missing a few seconds from the opening murder, mostly from the slow pan of the dead girl's body hanging from the ceiling. There's a noticeable jump cut in the music score when this happens. Did we notice that?
I mean, it's hard to tell sometimes because, you know, the way some of his films are cut.
Yeah.
So it wasn't anything that stuck out to me.
That's odd because that previous UK DVD doesn't mention that, so.
Maybe what?
Yeah, that's 94 minutes, 18 seconds, and this new one supposedly 94 minutes, 13 seconds.
What about the, I've been thinking about trying to source the the Anchor Bay collection edition.
Right.
DVD, because that's supposedly kind of the most accurate colours and things like that. So, need to check on that, see if it's...
Is it on Blu-ray in the States?
No, not yet. Right, They're talking about maybe Anchor, either Anchor Bay or Blue Underground bringing it out.
Okay.
But, well, that's quite interesting. Again, all our information's from Melon Farmers.
Yes.
Which you can see yourself. Cool. So
any final thoughts?
I'm looking forward to seeing Inferno.
Right.
I'll say that.
Definitely one of Argento's best. A lot of maybe the problems I had with other films don't really exist here. I think it's got quite masterful control of mise-en-scène. It's really good use of deep staging, which was notable in Tenebrae for not being that great. Remember that? Because the commentary said, the staging's amazing here.
Yeah, with the five characters on screen and stuff. But yeah.
So, recommend it.
Definitely. Cool. So that wraps us up for our conversation on Suspiria. We'll now move on to the second section of the podcast. So welcome to Random Shit, the part of the podcast where we discuss any news items or basically any other bullshit that we can think of.
Indeed.
So Gary, any news items for us to discuss?
Well, been away for a bit,
so it's
quite a lot of stuff. But we start with Arrow.
Sure.
They've been quite busy. Recently, they've announced that they're going to be bringing out Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 in a nice box set. Can't remember when that's coming. Is it October?
I think it's
16th, I think.
Interestingly enough, if anyone's wanting to pre-order that, the Arrow are doing it on their own website for $19.99 until the 12th of August. But if you do not want to pay up front, Amazon are doing it just now for $22.50, which not bad at all, considering you don't pay till the date of dispatch, and there's a chance that either that will go back up to, it was at $34.99 before that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sometimes Amazon, it might even come down again. So, but I'd try and pick that up. If you don't fancy paying up front, then that's a cracking deal for $3 more, really.
Yeah.
Can you tell the stuff about it?
Yeah, it looks like a great set. It's also going to include Hooper's first film, Eggshells.
Mm-hmm. And the short film that he did as well.
Yeah,
Both in high def, as far as I can tell.
And a wealth of extras.
I mean, 3-disc set, 2 Blu-rays and a DVD.
Yeah.
Some nice, really nice packaging looking. Kind of similar to, but looks better than even their Battle Royale set.
Okay,
I mean, the Battle Royale Ryle set's nice, but this looks more, a little more kind of artistic, you know what I mean? Interesting artwork and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, with regards to the film, I don't like it all that much, but the box set around it just makes me want to buy it. If it had just been like a standard disc, then I probably wouldn't have bothered. No. But that 100-page booklet, the documentary about Hooper talking about his career, and the other films on there, just make it worth picking up, I think.
I'd been going to pick up the US Bare Bones, well, not Bare Bones, there's a commentary and things like that on it for a while, because it's pretty cheap, but I'm so glad I held off now, because I do actually quite like this film, I'm quite fond of it. I remember going once when I lived in Glasgow, to the, what was it called, the UCG? The big cinema, Cine World now.
Yeah.
But when it first opened in, you know, like
UGC.
UGC, that's the one. And I went to see this film myself, like, and I think I must have been like one of maybe four people in the cinema.
Right.
Because they were showing like in a late night showing of this film, first time I'd ever seen it.
Okay.
But I've got a wee place in my heart for this film. It doesn't hold up to anything like the original, don't get me wrong, but it's an interesting kind of little kind of fun film. I would have got this eventually, but this just is like a dream come true for anyone who likes this film.
Yeah.
And even people who aren't even that fond of it, as you admit, you know. a dream come true for fans of Toby Hooper, really.
Yeah.
So that's pretty epic. I mean, that's the kind of their biggest kind of like packaging kind of style release. They've done in a while. It makes you wonder why they picked that. You know, just because of the name of Texas Chainsaw, do you think that's...
I guess so.
Get away with doing that?
I mean, it seems like Hooper's one of the directors they want to kind of focus on. The Life Force as well. It's coming out recently. They're not going to get Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I guess, so it's the kind of next best thing.
I guess so. It's a kind of shame, like, because it makes the Texas Chainsaw Massacre Blu-ray look a little inferior, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the kind of, I mean, it's loaded with extras, but it's just a plain old box, isn't it?
Although there is that German box set.
Is there?
That I quite like. I might pick that up. Although it's got like the nice book and some beautiful packaging. What the book is in German, obviously, but
yeah,
might be worth it. I think it'll look quite nice next to Gary's Foreign Corner. But yeah, it's got some additional extras and documentaries and stuff, so might be worth picking up.
And definitely, I mean, I'm just going to look it up just now, actually. But
is it a print, I think, but it's not going for prices that are too crazy on Amazon.de.
That's an awesome one. I'm really excited about that. That kind of came out of left field as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite as bad as the Nosferatu announcement, but that's arguably more exciting because of the packaging and all that stuff. Uh-huh. Cool. What else we got? Nations-wise?
At that same announcement, they announced also Charles Laughton's Night of the Hunter.
Right.
So an amazing film.
That's a Criterion.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's going to be the same master.
Right. Okay. That's good.
Which was a UCLA film restoration. It's slightly, they've scaled down some of the extras compared to the Criterion, but
Any exclusives, as far as I can remember,
but if you don't want to import the Criterion, then it's a good second option. And also Fury, which I don't know, it's a Brian De Palma.
No, I mean, I don't really know much of his stuff,
but they're making a big investment into his catalogue.
I know. They're doing a lot of kind of package deals with like Obsession, Fury and what's it called, the John Ford one? Dress to Kill, they're doing that as well, and what's the one?
Blow It.
They're doing like kind of package deals with those and stuff, so they seem to be definitely getting right into the palm.
And then some more stuff for quarter four, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1978, I think, the remake. Wes Craven's People Under the Stairs, Robert Altman's A Long Goodbye, and BTILT, which I can't remember what that is.
Big Trouble in China. Carpenter's film. Yeah. That's one I'm quite excited about because, again, that was one I've never seen, but I wanted to pick up on Blu-ray, and again, it was out in the States. But I think this is getting a steelbook and everything.
Okay.
With the original artwork and stuff. Mm-hmm. Don't know what the normal edition will look like, but the steelbook looks pretty cool.
Aye.
And depending on the extras, it'll probably a worthy pickup. like you? Or are you getting more?
That's all for the Arrow stuff.
Sure.
But...
I'd mention it to you, but I mean, people may not be aware, but the Scream Factory label are bringing out Assault and Precinct 13.
Oh, yeah.
John Carpenter's first film. As I said, I'm kind of a Carpenter fan, so that's one, again, that you kind of had to buy two different versions to kind of get the best print and the best extras. Mm. I think the American one had a good print, but no extras at all, and there was like a German one that had all the extras kind of thing. Whereas this Scream Factory seems like it's not maybe going to have all the extras, but it's going to have a decent amount. And a nice like transfer, brand new transfer and stuff right, like that. So that's something. I mean, I remember buying that in DVD, like the first time it was out in DVD over here, and it was like called a collector's edition, right?
Right.
And it was like there was nothing on it. Like it was like, literally just the film, and the box was like a kind of cardboard like opener.
Right.
It's hard to describe. It was like kind of. I think what it'd be like. Like you know how sometimes you get kind of deluxe greeting cards in a box.
Okay.
Right, it was that, but it was obviously hinged and opened.
Right,
And there wasn't even a book in it. Well, there wasn't even a book. It looked like this should be like this kind of like epic, you know, collector's edition set or something like that, and there was nothing, and it was really poor. So this is kind of, I'm quite glad that they're going to bring that out. Do you have any else, news-wise?
What else we got?
Is there any Criterion announcements?
Yes, I was going to briefly mention them.
Mm-hmm.
The October lineup. Some interesting stuff there. This is when they traditionally do like the horror movie thing for Halloween.
Oh yeah, right.
So they announced a couple of horror themed films. Eyes Without a Face.
That's one I really want to check out.
Yeah.
You said you've seen it.
Yes.
Before? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Very good film.
Mm-hmm.
Been waiting for that to get an upgrade for a while. They also announced some kind of lighter horror ones, that kind of noirish. A film called The Uninvited from I think mid-40s.
Right.
It's one of the first like haunted house movies that treated the theme seriously without making a kind of comedy thing about it.
Right.
But that's pretty decent. I watched it the other week there. I hadn't heard of it before, but it's not bad. The kind of lighter one was I Married a Witch, which is a kind of, that's more of a comedy. Starring Veronica Lake.
Hmm.
More of a screwball comedy, but she's a witch.
Right. Yeah. Bewitched.
Yeah.
Bewitched.
Another big one was the John Cassavetes set, which were they released in DVD.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a 5-film set, but they've announced they're bringing it to Blu-ray.
Right, okay.
So that's quite a big kind of canonical title for the collection, so I'll be picking that up at some point.
You got it in DVD or?
No. The only annoying thing was I thought like Eraserhead was a shoe-in for an October announcement.
Right.
But
has that only been released in Blu-ray here?
Well, it doesn't have a US release, but it has been released in a few other countries.
Yeah, sorry, I meant.
So I don't know. Maybe they're holding off for a Lynch. Like normally do like box sets November. I don't know if there might be.
You think there's any truth to the Mulholland Drive? They haven't really mentioned it again. Did they deny it or?
They didn't deny it. No.
Guess they're not going to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see.
Would you think if it wasn't true, they would have come out and said straight away, "Listen, like that was just a, that was just a thing we thought."
No, they don't do that.
Right.
Really.
Okay.
Let's
keep you guessing, I guess.
Yeah. The James Dean set that we knew were coming has been up for pre-order and all that. There's a few different variations in the different versions
of the different countries, you mean?
Between the US and UK, you've got your full box set, which is a 7-disc. You've got the US digibooks, and you've got the UK smaller box set.
So what's the US digibooks?
Yeah,
are they the films individual?
Yeah, individual films, but unfortunately they're just the films. No, that because the special features are on the DVDs.
Ah, right, okay.
So
right,
which.
That's a bit.
I would have went for the digibooks, but it's annoying. So yeah, cheapest version is the UK version, which is what's well, a the US box set is a 7-disc. The UK box set is 6-disc, but all you're really missing is a documentary on George Stevens,
okay,
who directed Giant, which you could pick up individually.
Mm, okay.
It's a wee bit annoying thinking you're throwing that in. Probably a rights issue or something.
Sure.
But yeah, I think for in terms of money wise, I'm just gonna go for the UK one. Saves hassle importing a big box like that is always a bit risky. You never know, it's gonna have a massive ding in the corner or something.
Yeah,
and then you're gonna hit by customs.
Aye. Mm-hmm.
So unfortunately it's the half size book and stuff like that. You don't get the big full big book, but $17.99 at Sainsbury's. I'm gonna
go for that.
Slap my money down.
Yeah.
Tempted to pick up the digibooks as well, but we'll see.
That's a future. At least it'll be in English.
Aye.
I'm just looking at Blu-ray.com actually just now. Just a couple of things that I meant to bring up. Like, so we're talking there about Jungle Book was released in Diamond Edition. See, they're doing Sleeping Beauty in Diamond Edition as well.
The US one.
There's apparently some new special features on. Just pissed me off quite a bit, because if you remember, I got into a bit of hot water with my wife getting the anniversary edition Blu-ray that's currently out.
Yeah, the platinum edition. Yeah.
I got into a bit of hot water getting that.
Did you pay over the odds for that?
No, not too bad. Right. It was just at a time that we didn't have much. We're a bit strapped for cash, right, okay. And I thought, okay. Remember you said about I should have got it sent here and stuff like that.
Oh, right.
And, so I don't know what the new content's going to be on that.
I mean, it's pretty stacked, that one. So
yeah,
what can they add? I don't know.
Some
of the newer features have been a bit thin on the ground, not been that incredible.
Robin Hood's coming as well, I believe.
Yeah, it's out.
Yeah, in the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's coming UK as well.
Yeah. But I think that the print for that wasn't great either. We were talking about Sword in the Stone before.
I thought the Robin Hood one was decent.
Maybe it was like three and a half review, or something. Okay. Like, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but.
But yeah, I picked up the Jungle Book, the UK Diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
The only downside of that is I'd recycled one of the bonus features.
Oh.
It was Growing Up with the Nine Old Men, which is on the US Diamond of Peter Pan, but wasn't on the UK Peter Pan. So,
how does that work for the US Jungle Book?
Well, that's what I'm thinking. Who knows? Are they going to do a new special feature that's going to be exclusive?
Sure.
Might be a bit annoying, but the fact that this came with a slip, I thought, and it's cheaper, so I'm just gonna just went with that.
I don't remember, because we've done the podcast. Was the 35th anniversary Halloween announced then?
We talked about it, but we didn't know it was a digi.
Right, so so that's been announced, obviously. Yeah. And it's gonna be the first run anyway. It's gonna be a digi book.
Mm.
There's a new commentary on there with John Carpenter and Jamie Lee Curtis. There's not as much new content as I was hoping for, but to be honest, it recycles a few things from previous releases. There's two or three new kind of HD, between 10 and 20 minute features.
Okay.
Plus the new commentary, which is fine, and obviously there's a new transfer and done things like that. I don't know if they'll announce any more content for that. I mean, hopefully, just I don't know. Like, for some reason, it just feels like this should be the fucking definitive, set. And it feels like we've seen a lot of this stuff already.
Mm.
And even a new commentary, I don't know what new stuff is going to be gleaned from it.
Right.
Personally, I don't know. I mean, but I have pre-ordered it. But yeah, it looks, hopefully it'll be a really nice set. I'm not sold on the artwork yet. It looks nice enough, but I like the original artwork I do, and I think they could have maybe done something different.
Yeah.
The white, that seems kind of... Sorry,
I actually preferred that one that was the kind of the stock picture before.
Kind of orange one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't mind that. I would have been okay with that, I think. But it's fine. I'm sure it'll look really nice. Hopefully it's a really nice high quality digi. It's Anchor Bay, I think, that's doing it, is it?
Yeah.
I don't know if they've done any digis before. It's actually, I mean, looking at it again, it's actually not as white as I thought it was.
Right,
It's got quite a lot of black actually. It's just different than what I was, I guess I was thinking it would be.
Has it been announced for a UK release, is it?
Not yet, no.
Just we are talking about extras here, I wonder if the UK might get more. Unlikely, as we know, like, fees for the BBFC and all that, but there's been a couple of, like, extensive interviews and documentaries that Mark Kermode does, and I think McArthur.
Right, right.
So I wonder if any of they could see light of day.
Well, that would be interesting. Yeah. I mean, certainly, one thing that really bummed me out about it is, I'd like to the TV cut.
Oh, aye.
There's a well-known TV cut of Halloween that has about 12 extra minutes in it that Carpenter shot while they were shooting Halloween 2. And it was released eventually over here in DVD in like the mid, like, 2001, 2002 or something like that. And it got like a full release in the US for a while, and then they kind of, it was a limited edition, it got discontinued and you couldn't get that edition anymore. And so I remember having to import my first copy of Halloween on DVD from the US and stuff, that I've still got that. And then it eventually came out over here and they had the two disc set, and it was like, one was the TV. But you'd think they would maybe do, I mean, maybe they can't do an HD version of it, but at least give us like a, I think it, I don't know if it was reframed, if all the stuff they shot for the, but maybe, I don't know actually, I have to look at my DVD again, you know, right, if it was shot in widescreen or not.
Does Carpenter kind of approve that cut? If that was an official version of the TV, like that one, or
I don't know how much he approves it. Like, right. He shot the extra stuff for it, and it was to make the film up for, to be shown, so it could be shown on TV. You know, they needed an extra 12 minutes, something. It was something about the length of, I don't know what it was all about, but it was basically just to add in, and it adds in some backstory. There's a few scenes of, there's a scene near the beginning where Loomis is in like a courtroom type thing, talking to Michael's doctors, and he's pleading with them to keep them locked up, and he's explaining why, and then that's before the scene where he escapes the asylum. So it's kind of cool. It's adds wee bits maybe that don't necessarily need to be in the film. Obviously, the film works without it, but I don't know. It's a nice thing to have, I think. Personally, I mean, like the Halloween 2 Blu-ray that Scream Factory brought out, they gave you like a DVD version of Halloween 2. A TV cut, which I'd never seen before. It's got a few different things. I think the gore's more reduced. Like some of the stuff that I think Carpenter shot some stuff for Halloween 2, the theatrical cut, that upped the gore a wee bit, whereas this is more like kind of original tone, what they were maybe going for with it, to more be like the original, you know, less kind of 80s slasher. You know, cool. Like the kind of Friday 13th kind of up to gore a wee bit. So it would have been nice to like have that. That added in with the new extra stuff, I think would definitely be like, you'd be like, well, that's a really good package, and it's probably going to be it for a while. I mean, maybe they'll announce that they're going to have that. It just seems a lot of like films do the two cuts now, you know what I mean? Like, you know, your extended or theatrical, your international, your director's cut. It just seems like it's a shame not to have that on there. So, it's getting a new 7.1 surround job.
Right.
which will be nice as well. That'll be, I mean, it's pretty good on even the Blu-ray. The audio, so it'll be nice to, but nice to see it remastered. Anyway, so Gary and I have been wondering and thinking about our pickup section. We usually do a section where we talk about the new stuff we've managed to scrape together money for. But what's your thoughts on that section, Gary?
Yeah, well, I would assume that's the least interesting part of the show for the listeners. Just because I don't know if it's something that works in an audio format. I don't know. The kind of thinking behind it was not really to show off what we've been buying, but just to kind of another excuse to talk about the kind of just home video and things like compare versions and things like that.
Exactly. I think we kind of probably set out to be was like, oh, I've got like these two versions of this film, but I've got this new one.
Yeah.
And the reason I've got this one is because it's a better print, it's better sound, it's got this documentary on it that the other one doesn't have, you know, whereas it feels like it's become like us being like, look at what we got.
Right.
Kind of like, you know, a wee bit dickheadish.
Maybe.
Maybe. I mean, not like that, not intentionally, but like it feels like maybe like it just sounds like I was just rattling off.
Yeah, yeah.
Spending our money, you know? which is not really what we wanted to be, and it's a bit, as you say, it's a bit kind of boring. I mean, we did speak back at the beginning about maybe putting up images of the things we picked up, but even that, I don't know if people would want to see that. I mean, there's probably images of these things out there, but I don't know. Is that like being complacent then? If you're saying all the stuff, there's already images out there, but people are listening here, and so like maybe we should. I don't know. It just seems like our photography skills aren't necessarily the best to capture these images.
Well, why? I don't know. If anyone's really loves that section,
yeah. If anyone, yeah.
let us know and we'll reconsider. But if it's a special release, we can. I want to say a lot of time. It's just like there's nothing really spectacular to say about an individual release.
Well, that's it. I mean, we're kind of collector fiends, really.
Yeah.
So generally, we either pick a lot of stuff. Anyway, especially me, I pick up just because either it's a cool package or it's really cheap and it's something I'm going to pick up anyway, but there's not always a lot of stuff to sell in the film.
Sure, yeah.
Which it seems kind of like boring maybe for people. But anyway, you can tell us, I mean, should we do it today?
Well, is there anything special you want to mention?
I picked up a nice Unforgiven digibook. Got it from Best Buy in the States or for like £6 or something like that. I thought that was a really good price. So I didn't even know it was out on digibook. It was just per chance. I've never actually seen the film, but it's meant to be pretty decent. But the digibook's lovely. It's really nice. It's the artwork that's pretty well known. Just nice wraparound. I have thought about a new section we could do, because Gary's went into buying his foreign steelbooks and digibooks that don't you kind of read. So what we might introduce is Gary's Foreign Buys Corner.
Right, aye.
So think of a good name for it, you know. And we'll get Gary to read a section from his... that might be a good competition. Get you to read a section from a digibook and get someone to translate it.
Okay.
See what's been said. But we might do that. That'd be quite fun, because you could read a bit from like a digibook, right? And then I have to work out what it is.
Okay.
They're saying I could work.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're gonna pilot this little section of the podcast. We're currently calling it Sprechen die Digi. And the aim of it is Gary has a plethora of foreign digibooks and steelbooks, and Gary's going to read me some lines from either a digibook or a steelbook, and I have to try and guess what the film is and maybe what the sentence is to do with, even though we have no way of confirming that. So Gary will put in a nice wee jingle for this maybe at some point, maybe not this episode, we'll see. So here we are, the trial run of Sprechen die Digi.
Okay. So this is the first.
Are you going to tell me which language it is in?
Yes, I was going to.
Okay, right, okay.
This is German.
Sure.
So.
Right.
What's that? We did 6 years of German at school, so.
Yeah, yeah. Did that? Yeah, I did some primary school as well. How are you going to do it if we have any Japanese ones?
That's true.
That's going to be modern, isn't it? How are you going to? We won't do that then.
Right.
Only ones we actually can read.
Probably limited to European
and kind of
countries.
And phonetically pronounce.
Okay, here we go.
Right.
Weltweit ein Meilenstein der Computeranimation.
Okay, so it's a Pixar film.
Right. Mit diesem zweifach Oscar prämierten Kinofolg haben sich die Schöpfer von Findet Nemo und Oben.
Is it Finding Nemo?
No.
Oh, right, okay, so we're talking like Pixar, and they're saying from the people that did, like, you know, Finding Nemo.
Yeah.
It's the same folk that did that, right, okay, right.
Selbst übertroffen. Zum ersten Mal wird verraten, wie Monster wirklich sind.
Monsters, Inc.?
Ah.
Oh, nice. Don't know what they were saying. So from the people that brought you fucking Finding Nemo and Toy Story and all that gash.
A milestone in computer animation with the 2-time Oscar winning studio, making films, Finding Nemo, and Up.
This has to be a section. I like this. Right, so there's actors' names here. Right, I'm not going to read them. Right, okay. So, here we go. Sprechen die Digi. Just have that in every time, right, before we do one. Okay, it's French.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if I can do French.
Right.
Récompensé par l'Oscar de la meilleure actrice. Signe sa plus belle performance dans ce thriller de un intense rare release par.
Something about an intensive performance, Oscar right. winning.
Right.
So far, right.
Okay, here's some more. Rivalité dans la troupe du New York City Ballet. Nina est prête à tout pour obtenir le rôle principal du lac de Cygnes. Cool. She had done a bit gem one, shouldn't I? Lambingu Thomas.
Right, it's Black Swan then.
Yes, that's right. I don't know. Well, again, I know what that'll say. I'm talking about the ballet and Nina's wanting the role there.
Right, yeah.
And that. So just, the other bit was like, it was talking about Natalie Portman and Darren Aronofsky and the people okay. that were in it. It's kind of random, but not random, right. but like it wasn't really a synopsis. I think I realised that halfway through. Anyway, that was a little trial for that. it could be quite interesting if we stick to languages we can pronounce. So, any other ideas for games? Or just come up with one? The Gary Sprechen Dibba Digi.
How can we talk? That's a
fucking
pretty
topper, isn't it? It's like. So I think that's what brings us to the end of the show, Gary. Had some good times.
Yeah.
So, we. Are going to look at another film next time, I believe.
We are.
Yeah, what film are we going to be looking at, Gary?
Well, it was scheduled to be Carnival of Souls.
Sure, right, okay. That sounds as if it's changed somehow, Gary. Very dramatic there. Well, it was scheduled
what
to
was
be.
What was suggest was yes. turn it into a double feature.
Double feature? Yeah. That's like two for the price of one.
It is.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Right.
Yeah. If we worked in dollars, but we'll say a pound. It's more expensive than a dollar, but
right,
no.
Aye.
Pound. Right, okay. So
you up for that?
No. So what was your thinking behind that?
Well, Carnival of Souls is sort of a so bad it's good
okay,
type of thing.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes with those type of films we've done in the past, we kind of get that much substance out of the film
okay.
to warrant a full, to give the audience some
the
value
money's worth.
For money.
Right,
even
for
though
free.
It's free.
Yes.
So I thought we could do two of them.
Do the same film twice?
No.
Just like you're just going to want to record the conversation and then back to back it. You could play it the second one in some sort of reverse
right.
to make it sound like it was in some sort of fake French language. Because we can do French not so well. So what do you mean? Like, do two of them?
No,
what do you do two of them?
Yeah,
is there a sequel to Carnival of Souls?
No, but
Carnival of Souls 2? Bigger Carnival? Circus of Souls? Theme Park of Souls?
Yeah.
No?
Well, we could do them.
Is there a line in this film?
But, I thought we could do Equinox.
Okay, yeah. I see what you're saying. Do two different films that are too bad that they're good. I see. Understood. So, Equinox.
Thematic link.
Oh, got it. Equinox from, what year is that from?
I think it's late 60s, but
right.
I'm not sure. These are both films that are in the Criterion collection.
Sure.
Two of my favourites of that style.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Nice, yeah, I'm up for that. Two
Should
for
be
one.
Should have a fun watch. To
yeah,
do them
yeah, good laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Good laugh, Gary.
Yeah.
Hey, have a laugh, have a laugh. So that's going to be next time on Cinema Subculture. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Sorry for the long wait. Hopefully, God willing, after this month, we will get back to some sort of regular schedule of maybe like at least one a month. Hopefully, maybe back to like two a month at most. You know, like getting back to that maybe. I know. But we're going to try, Gary, eventually. We will try because we will. Yeah.
Right.
No?
Oh, I should try.
No, I think, I mean, yeah, I think we will. My situation's getting better after this month. Right. Money back to normal, okay. Stuff like that, so I should be able to afford to come more often.
Right.
Sometimes that's been an issue when I can't afford to come and stuff like that. So it will, honestly.
Okay.
I'll be better, right. So, yeah, so we can only thank you for bearing with us. Thank you for coming back. I know we're still getting kind of like regular amount of listeners on the past couple of episodes, and people tune in for the special episode we did, the Nosferatu announcement. So thanks for continuing to stick by us, even though we're giving you very little. Or like that, the too hot girlfriend, you know, just giving you enough. Oof. Just giving you enough to get you to come back. But, you know, we promise to give you the goods and get you to, like, second or third base like next time.
Mm.
I was going to say something. Oh, yeah. We could pimp the Facebook and stuff like that, Gary. You want to give it a shout out?
If you want to get in touch or check out what we're up to, you can log on to facebook.com/cinemasubculture.
Yeah, give us a like.
Mm-hmm. You could, if you want to email us, it's hotmail.com. No, what? It's cinema_subculture.
Okay. Okay.
I'm forgetting how to use email addresses.
Yeah. So what Gary's trying to say is, also if you want to email us, you could email us at, also if you want to email us, this can be done by sending an email, an electronic mail, to through your computer or your phone. Smartphones work as well, Gary, do you know that? You can send an e-phone, no? You can send an email through your phone. Aye. No, that Steve Jobs wasn't fucking about, he was. Mm-hmm. What was I saying? Yes, cinema_subculture@hotmail.com. I really should just have made that cinema subculture, shouldn't I? Thought it'd been clever than the underscore.
Right.
I thought it was clean, you know, separating it up a wee bit, you know, it's just I made it one word, shouldn't I? I'm a dick. But anyway, so cinema_subculture@hotmail.com, and Gary or I will both reply to you. Or one of us will. So again, thanks very much for joining us for this episode. Next time, Carnival of Souls and Equinox.
Ah, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Whatever you want.
Potato. Yes. And that about wraps us up, Gary. So thanks for joining us. I've been Simon. He's been Gary.
Yeah.
He's lost his tongue. We can do French.
Thanks for listening.
Ciao.
Nightmare.